Imagine there was a video show made by professionals.
I
Wouldn't that be
can't imagine
crazy?
that. No.
My friend Marcy Massaro is saying that she's looking for someone to do ad sales. Like, you know how we get our sponsors by random hook and crook begging? Marcy's hiring somebody for some friend of theirs to do it for like a really well-produced, really good video show. And she says a few times, "I'm talking high quality." And I'm like, "Not us. Not us." So,
Hey.
hey, on the backpack show today, we've got two guests that I picked, so I'm too excited about this. One was I have a buddy up in New York who's doing some really cool stuff, doing some food consulting and is a military guy at West Point. And he said, "You got to meet my friend Chad Williams. This guy is something else." And the minute I met Chad Williams, this guy says, he says, "You're gonna," he goes, "I just knew. I knew there was a big glow there. I know he's got stuff going on."
Is that
And he
the
runs
Chad Williams, founder of Due Process?
founder of Due Process. That's the one. So we're gonna talk to Chad Williams today. We're gonna get the inside skinny. We're going to learn about what kind of streetwear he's bringing, where it goes from there.
The cause he
And
supports.
yeah. So then, in another case, my buddy Randall Ward was asking me some questions and looking around for some people to know and meet some new business friends. And I found him a SaaS CEO who has done incredible work. Her name is Savitri Wilson. She does a product that's twofold. It's on one side, it serves a whole bunch of nonprofits. And on the other side, if you're a funder or someone who's giving money into nonprofits, it shows you all the things you need to know, like where did that money go anyway? So this is a big day today. So we've got Texas in the house. We've got Canada on the house. We've
So
got
you can
Scotland,
book guests.
Vegas. I can, don't make it a habit or nothing, but yes, sometimes, occasionally, I could book a guest.
Hi everyone, Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz, welcoming you to the Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
You love that Dora comes back to visit us?
I do, and she's from Canadiana today. So
What's the difference? Is that a real thing? I don't know. Like if that's like a special part of Canada that
maybe it's
is a
Canada's
nickname.
Louisiana or something. I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. So we've got a lot of stuff to cover today. I want to whip through the ads just to make sure we get those handled. We had Johnsonville Appreciation Day yesterday, so
It
we get
was so good.
all the sausage you're
I
ever
have
going to get.
coupons, everyone. So if you want some free sausage, I'm looking at you, Chad Williams, backstage. I have many coupons, so you just tell me what kind you like that they have in your area, and I will mail you some coupons. And I'm getting
And
some for Johnsonville, Canada. Dora.
forthcoming, we had to actually, broker a trade deal. Justin Trudeau's in on it. We're
That's
asking
true.
Queen Elizabeth her take. All right, let me read the rest of my. Yeah, you missed Sausage Day. It was yesterday. It was
Hey,
big.
but we can send you coupons.
Right. Hey, if you want to make a show like this, you could do it on StreamYard. cbrogan.me/StreamYard. My goodness, how easy it is to run a show. We do it.
Chris
We're
even
trained
booked
on it.
guests today. That's how you know it's easy.
If you think that this show is great, but you cannot stand to look at our face anymore, we have an audio podcast and you can find it anywhere that podcast exists. Apple and Spotify have both gotten rid of the word subscribe. So now you must follow our
That's
podcast.
right, because people thought they'd have to pay for stuff if it said subscribe. Hi,
So,
Len Joy.
best-selling author Len Joy is here.
He's the best.
So Castos is who hosts our podcast. So you can go to castos.com to get your own podcast hosted. My gosh, it's easy. It is ridiculously easy to use their interface. Everything works wonderfully, like a charm, some might say. And our website, The Backpack Show, is thebackpackshow.online. Do you want a .online domain? Think about it. Streetwear.online. I wonder if it's even available. If it is, I can get it to you for 99 cents. Just use the code Chris, all caps, at checkout. 99 cents, Chad Williams. I'm talking to you right now. And we're sponsored by PubSite. Pub-site.com for all our author friends. Author Len Joy maybe knows a thing or two about what PubSite does because he works with FSB Associates, the engine behind the machine. Pub-site.com. Didn't that sound good? That was a good one.
Yeah, sort of.
So Leslie Goslin's here. Everybody's here. So I'm going to grab Chad Williams. We're going to talk about due process. And this is an interesting experience. I am so happy that I got to book people, but like always, we book from
You're so
very
happy.
different spaces.
You're like, I got to book people.
I did. I'm a real boy. Okay, I'm grabbing Chad Williams.
You go
Hey,
ahead.
Chad, how are you?
Hey guys, how are you guys doing?
We made it happen.
Bonjour.
Get all those pirates that I say with the best sausage. Absolutely. Email Carrie, you'll get some sausage.
We
Due
get coupons.
process.
I'll send you coupons.
We need to talk a little bit about the process of do-ness. how did this come about? I know the origin story, but it's quite the origin story, Chad. So I guess we got to start there. What happened that made you even think you wanted to get into this kind of business?
All right. So brace yourself, guys. It's a hard story. Comes out with a good ending, though. All right. So I'm currently 22 years old, and I'm my junior year in college. Went out with a couple of friends. We went out to a club, pre-COVID, of course. And we were enjoying ourselves. We were having the time of our lives. One of our friends, she started throwing up. The bouncer said she had to leave the club. So we had called the Uber off of her phone. We were going to send her home. We couldn't find the Uber initially. We finally find the Uber. I see the Uber driver, the left side of his face is bleeding. So he's bleeding. Oh. Yeah, it was crazy.
Whoa.
He's bleeding. So like in my head, I'm like, oh, shoot. What to do now? The police officers, they come behind me and they're like, excuse me, sir, step away from the car. I'm like, this is an Uber. I'm trying to put her in the Uber. They're like, step away from the car. So I just back up. They asked the Uber driver, who was told to do? He pointed at me.
So, yeah, what? So, like, yeah. He just drove up and you were just there your friend.
This was the thing. We were looking for him for a little while because we couldn't find him at first because it was like packed outside. So I guess by the time we found him, somebody had assaulted him. Somebody had punched him.
Oh my gosh.
When I got there with the girl and the cops asked him that, he pointed at me. So I had to spend the night in jail, something that I never thought I would have to do. I was in college. I was just taking my classes. It was my junior year. I'm originally from New York and I was never arrested, but I came to college and I got arrested. So that was something that I never thought would happen. And like the worst part of it all was, I had to see the judge in the morning and she just looked like she hated me from like the first time she saw me. She appointed me a public defender. The public defender, he is unresponsive. She appointed the court date for 3 weeks after the incident. I was calling the public defender for like the whole 3 weeks and he didn't pick up any phone calls. He didn't respond to any emails and I just didn't know what to do. But luckily the day before court, he had responded to the emails. I went to him, I told him the whole story. I was like, it was downtown Buffalo. You could just go downtown there, get the cameras, and you could be able to prove my innocence. So I thought it was going to be an easy case. I thought I wouldn't have to, like, hire a private attorney. So we go on. We go to court. He doesn't have the footage. He just asks him if he has it. He just says no. He doesn't give, like, any reason behind it. He just said no. He just says no.
He didn't get it is why he didn't have it. He didn't
exactly.
ask for it.
He didn't do anything. So, like, I go throughout this for, like, a whole year, all while I'm in college, all while I'm working. So, it's all on my mental. And I live in Brooklyn. And Brooklyn to Buffalo is, like, a six-hour commute. So, I don't have to travel in the summertime because I didn't have school. I would have to travel from Brooklyn to Buffalo to go to court to fight this case. So, luckily, after the year, I was able to clear my name. The Uber driver said he wasn't sure of my identity anymore, but that was after a year. So, like, all of this already had took its toll on me and everything. So,
jeez.
That's the story of why behind that started due process.
So, from that experience, you thought not just that you're going to start a business, but you need to do something about the situation,
exactly.
The justice system, the systemic racism in that system.
Exactly. So should I go into like explaining what due process is though?
Well, that's just it. I was going to say, so you get dragged for a year and, yeah. You know, a lot of people would have just, I don't know, been indignant, tweeted bad things, been unhappy about your lot in life or whatever, or just played a lot more NWA. But you didn't. You said, I'm going to make something out of this. So talk about it. What'd you do?
All right. So yeah, due process, we're a clothing brand that advocates for social justice, Drew Streetwear. We try to create like aesthetically pleasing designs. The reason I did it with streetwear because like I grew up in New York and we always like the latest fashion. We always like the newest things in fashion, the newest Jordans, the newest gear, everything. So I thought it would be a cool thing to combine two things I was passionate about, which was social justice and streetwear, and like put it in one. So I named the clothing brand Due Process, DOO process, instead of the traditional way, DUE process, for trademark reasons and like to also put it in the streetwear category of things. For those that don't know, due process means it's a legal term. It refers to fair treatment through the judicial system, especially as a citizen's entitlement. And I thought that would be like the perfect name for the brand because I didn't get any due process. The cops didn't try to check if there's any blood on me or anything like that. They just arrested me. They took the guy's word for it and they arrested me. So like he just pointed at the first black face that he saw. And unfortunately, that's the results of a lot of black Americans. It happens to them a lot. And luckily, I was able to clear my name, but there's thousands of others that are not able to clear their names. And they have horrible public defenders that are not fighting their case accordingly. And they had the public defender either forces a plea deal on them, and they end up taking the plea deal, and they have to say they did a crime that they actually did it to get reduced time because they don't want to go to trial because they feel like the public defender is not able to adequately fight their case. So luckily, I was able to get out this thousands of others that are not, and that's why I started due process. And with every sale, we donate 15% of the proceeds to organizations that advocate for social justice. So like for the design that's on the screen right now, Walking While Black, it's the significance comes from Trayvon Martin. He didn't get any due process either. George Zimmerman, he decided to take the law into his own hands and kill Trayvon. And I call it Walking While Black because that's what Trayvon is. He was Walking While Black. And the design is it's a portrayal of Trayvon Martin. And his head is an O, like it's in the shape of an O as the second O in dual. And then his body is in the shape of a P as in the first letter of process. And with 15% of these proceeds, I wanted to donate it to the Trayvon Martin Foundation, but I wasn't able to hear back from them. So we decided to donate to Last Prisoner Project, their organization that advocates for weed offenses. Like, so there's a guy named Corbin Cooper. He got like life in prison for like a weed offense, and that's just crazy. Mm-hmm. But luckily, he was able to get out of jail due to the Last Prisoner Project. So that's one of the beneficiaries of this project. And then also the Western New York Peace Center, which they just advocate for social justice and better living all around.
Chloe says that's horrific. I'm sorry that happened to you. Carol says, so maddening, a whole year of this while you're going through school. The Dora says, amazing way to take a horrific experience and channel it into something positive. So lots of love for the project.
Thank you. Yeah. I feel like that incident caused something good to happen because, like, due process, I feel like it's really my passion. And then a lot of people are also passionate about it as well. And, like, through that, I was able to go through my senior year. I was able to enter a business plan competition. And due process was my business in that competition. Like, and without, like, any really real business background, I was able to win that competition. I think I was able to win that competition beating out schools like Cornell, Columbia, University at Buffalo, some Ivy League schools. I was able to win that competition because of like the mission behind due process and what due process stands for.
The story. The story alone would power your passion for the business, and that must have come across in all your presentations.
Thank you.
It's a tricky business doing a streetwear brand. They live or die pretty fast. There's a lot of chances to get it wrong. There's a lot of people that, you know, are kind of rolling for a while and then they're not. What's it like and sort of what's your experience with streetwear before launching your own?
Before launching my own, so I'd say I spent a lot of money on streetwear. So like a lot of Supreme, a lot of Babe. So I guess, yeah, I spent a lot of money on it. I always liked the culture of it. It was always different. It wasn't like the traditional fashion that you see on like the runways and stuff like that. But yeah, it was always like me and friends, like, the mornings before we had to go to class for college, we'd all just like be on our computers on the Supreme website trying to like get the latest gear that they drop in. So yeah, I'd say I was always a huge fan.
So you knew the product and what would make for a good one.
Exactly. And I feel like it's even better in a way because of the mission behind it.
Who does the designs? Do you or do you work with designers? Like, how does this work?
So I actually draw the designs myself, but I'm not able to graphic design it yet. So I actually outsource. So like I outsource to like a fellow college student, and she helps me with the designs. Jackie.
Wow.
Future plans for some of these other designs, or you know, are we sticking with Dopey for a while, or what's the Walking While Black, or what are you thinking about sort of rolling out the different designs as time rolls on? What's like the timing have to be in any typical clothing brand?
So with that, I would say it depends on the season. So yeah, that definitely depends on the season. And like, if you want to make like sweaters, if you want to make t-shirts for summer, make the hoodies for fall, make jackets, bombers for winter. So definitely with timing. And then like the different designs, I guess it will go along with like the beneficiary of that drop. So like, it'll like just have something to do what the beneficiary of the drop, the design will be based on that organization.
Do they work with you on the design? Like, do they give you feedback on it or on early kind of concepts?
No, not really. I would actually like pitch the design to them. So I'll have the design beforehand, and then I'll like pitch the design to them so that they can see, and then if they like it.
Yeah. It's like take it or leave it. We want to give you some free money. Take it or leave it.
So, a lot of interesting comments out there. A lot of congratulations. A lot of nice work and great story. Paul asked a question. Have you thought of launching new designs via Kickstarter? Now that's interesting. Just to imagine sort of the funding process of getting this all done. Are you doing anything like that? Like a money raise kind of situation?
Yeah. So with that, with Kickstarter, I definitely thought about it before. So I created a shirt in the summer, like after the George Floyd incident. And this shirt, it stated the Minneapolis Police Department use the force regulations on it. And like with one of those regulations, not the exact words for it, but it would basically state that if you see a fellow officer doing wrong, it's your duty to intervene and stop that officer from doing wrong. And obviously with the George Floyd incident, they didn't do that. So I created that shirt and I put different rules and regulations on the back of it. And with that, I was giving it away for free at protests. I was giving it away for free at local protests. Like in the case, like a protester was on the ground, the officer of the law, they would see like their rules that they swore to on the back of the shirt. And hopefully that would persuade them to follow it. And I wanted to start a Kickstarter behind that because I wanted to like raise funds to help pay for the shirt. Because I created some out of my own pocket for free and I was giving them away. But I actually went about doing it the GoFundMe way and I actually got donations to create more of those shirts. So that's what I did. But Kickstarter, nice. Was definitely a thought.
Are you hiring people now? Like, you mentioned that you went up against in that competition a lot of people who were maybe Ivy League educated, who had a lot of advantages. How are you building your team for due process so you'll be able to take them on like for the long term?
So building my team, I'll say from that business plan competition, I was approached by and I met with somebody named Marnie Levine of Launch New York. It's a venture capitalist firm based in Western New York. And basically what she offered me a job straight out of college and also to be able to work on my business. And I'm in like their Founders Go Big program where they put a spotlight on women-owned and minority-owned businesses. So I'm just like basically like networking through their network and I'm finding people. But I'm not hiring because, you know, I don't have enough money to hire.
Right. It's a side business right now.
I really like to say something. I like to think I'm working on it all the time, even when I'm working for Launch New York. But yeah, it's getting up there. So like, I have to like balance my time and everything. You know,
got to build your war chest. Carol asked the question: what did you study in school? Sounds like you maybe have some interest in law now.
Nah, yeah, 100% have interest in law. I was actually thinking about going to law school as well, and but I studied economics. But one of the future goals of due process is that I want to start like a due process law firm where we just like take out the need for public defenders. So like what we would do is the proceeds from the shirt, it will go towards that law firm. And like we would give money to law school students to like help put their way through law school. And then on the side, after they graduate, they pass the bar and everything, they would help out the due process law firm on the side, help fight cases for people that were wrongfully arrested.
Like do a lot more pro bono than the average?
Exactly, yes. But they would have like better defense.
Better than public, that's for sure.
Well, public defenders are not well funded or supported. So.
Exactly. I was about to get to that point too because I hate it.
Very few of them and they get really overburdened and then they just don't have the energy.
Exactly. So like I hated the guy at first, but while going through the business plan competition, I learned that they're actually underfunded and overworked. So I started to give him a little bit of sympathy, but you know, it's always a special place in my heart. So.
It's still awful. Like that still should not happen. And yet when you look at it, you realize they're just people like you and me that have only so many hours in a day and way more work than can get done. So it's a systemic problem. Right. And you're exactly right on how to address it. Coach Woodard's asking, for those of us who aren't streetwear wise, how can we support your cause? Like, do you have another GoFundMe? Is there another way people could help support the work you're doing if they don't necessarily wear the clothes?
As of right now, no, but I would say you could always donate to the different organizations that are out there. And then also you could probably buy like an article of clothing, give it to like a nephew, daughter.
You got some cool kids. Come on. In your family.
You gotta find somebody. Chad Williams, thank you so much for being on and giving us this conversation, giving us a sense of where you're going with it. And thanks for, you know, giving people a thought on maybe you don't just stop after you get let off of the case. Maybe you can actually go forward and do even bigger things.
Exactly. Thank you guys for having me.
Don't go away.
Stick around. We have more things to do with you. All right. We're going to grab Savitri Wilson. This is a whole change, right? So we go from a guy who had to get thrashed by the system, you know, and then falsely accused of something just out of the blue.
Elizabeth says, I hope you do go to law school. Brother's a law professor, and this is a big research area. Man.
Just bought a tea and a hoodie. Will I be the first Irish customer? He's from Ireland, Chad. Yeah, you'll be the first guy wearing that drip in Ireland. That's no question.
I don't know. Not the last, for sure.
You never know. I would have gone UK first. I'm going to grab Savitri Wilson. We're going to talk all about Resilia. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Best day ever.
So I know that's a tough act to follow. It's a SaaS company.
I'm like, we're switching gears completely, I feel like. But it's the thing is all in the same vein of like, how do you do good for people and how do you give back? So
right. Your business is doing good for people. So you're helping them spend the right time in the right places. What was your background before that you said, I think I could totally run a big ass SaaS company? What made you think, this is what I'm going to do with myself?
Absolutely. So for me, I actually started my first company fairly young. Chad is much younger than I am. But when I was 22, I started my first company, Solid Ground Innovations. And it was essentially a management consultancy agency. And we were helping nonprofit organizations, essentially serving as the back office in lieu of full-time employees. So bringing capacity to their day-to-day. We were also helping these large funders and private foundations and family foundations and corporations help define what their giving looked like, as well as bring technical assistance, which is supporting the organizations that they were funding, helping them be successful. And so I started thinking about the major gaps that we were experiencing, the silos between the grantees and the funders. And I thought about how dated and antiquated the technology was in our space to actually support the work that we were doing. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try to productize our services and deliver through a software solution, which gave rise to Resilia. So Resilia is definitely roughly over 10 plus years of my career, and now trying to take that and formalizing it into a tech company.
It's really nuts to look at. And sort of, and when I was reading the, when I was looking up and doing research on you for my other project, I was just like, you took on something that I hadn't seen anybody really going after, which was during Hurricane Katrina, for instance. The government did not rush in and fix that. They did not come and help. In fact, the best we had out there in the field was Walmart. Like, who in what universe was going to say, man, look at Walmart. Look what they're doing. That's great job, guys.
Right.
That's embarrassing as a nation and just incredible that nobody could do it. Was that the inkling? Did you say, I know I can help better? When you started things like Exempt Me Now and some of the earlier things that led to what is Resilia, was that what you saw and that's what you decided you wanted to go after?
Yeah, I think it was a part of it. Even before that, when I was in college, I was one of the recipients of the Bill and Melinda Gates Scholarship, which is pretty difficult to get. However, it's the largest scholarship in the world that you can get to go to college. And they essentially pay everything. But I was 18 coming into LSU. And so they fly out all the scholars from all across the country, from Harvard, Yale, all the schools that they supported. And they're all students of color. And so that's like the, you know, description of everyone coming together. And it's interesting because now they have like 1,000 students, 18-year-olds, and they have us in this like beautiful resort area. And they're essentially trying to tell us, you know, you're going to go off and have these amazing careers, but don't forget your communities that you come from. Don't forget to prioritize like doing good. And so I do feel like that was kind of like the seed that was planted even earlier on before Katrina. Katrina also happened when I was in college, and you're absolutely right. Most people with COVID-19, it was the first time that their entire world changed overnight. For me, that was Hurricane Katrina. Like, our entire world changed overnight. And we did see like the response. It's something that I saw that was happening with COVID-19. I was like, okay, here comes the government. Let's see what they try to throw at people. Here come the foundations and charitable organizations trying to figure out how do they support communities, how do they stand up these funds. And so, yeah, I do feel like Katrina kind of gave me a lesson in disaster, not a pandemic, but definitely a lesson in disaster and how to respond.
And the big mess that government responds to any kind of disaster can be. Yeah, I was like, they should have mailed the vaccine to the Marx Brothers. Like, you're just running around.
Yeah, nobody knows what's going on.
Savitru, and I looked it all over. It's sort of funny. SaaS companies are thought of as sexy. You know, we think of Salesforce or we think of, you know, all the shiniest ones. You have such a non-sexy, super important business. Your business is like, I want to make sure the money goes to the right people. I want to make sure a nonprofit doesn't spend their time wound up in software hell when they could be just working on the mission they have to serve. Did you think of that? Like, was that in your mind? You know, is it cause first, or is it like, I know these non-sexy problems need to be solved. I know I can apply some really easy smarts to make it work. Like, where's the chicken? Where's the egg here?
So it's interesting because I also describe it the same way. Not only just SaaS, but the work that we're doing as like being kind of non-sexy work, but the work that needed to get done. And particularly because there's more capital, more money being just deployed via philanthropy corporations today than like ever in history, right? So you hear these billionaire pledges being started. You hear people committing to give away their entire wealth before their lifetime. And so we've never seen this type of money being deployed in modern history. And like, what is the responsibility behind that? And then how do we actually see change happen? And how do we create collective impact, whereas we all are moving towards the same problems to find solutions for, versus just throwing money at things and like, oh, you know, that $200 billion that we sent to Newark, New Jersey, it was a good idea, but it didn't work. 90% of it went to consultants, and we don't know where the other amount went either. And so how do we solve for those problems so that all of this money that is being pushed out in society today are going to the right places and are going for the right purposes and are actually helping the right people? And most importantly, how do we democratize philanthropy and change really what has been like a very old school way of getting money out? And how do we create access for more people and more organizations to receive it?
On both sides of that equation, there's so many pieces. Like, for instance, to your point, there's a lot of people deploying resources that are just not going where they should go, or they're going to what like seems like a good idea. And I talked once to Manoj Bhargava, who started 5-Hour Energy Drink and who does massive projects for India. But he says that everyone's putting their money in the wrong spots. Like, you know, they're trying to make these things that would be great if a village had electricity.
Right.
And he goes, and that's not what happens all the time, you know? So you've seen that. On the other side, nonprofits get really mired in they're so mission heavy that they're not function and process bred. How do you speak to that side of it for a minute? The nonprofit side, how do you help them understand, you know, we could just put this all to rest. Like, you, if you just did this, then you could go out and hug more babies or whatever your job is.
Yeah. So that's something that we really hone in on, particularly for organizations that are smaller and grassroots and that are on the ground in community. They don't necessarily have the capacity as some of these larger organizations, and particularly not to compete for funding, right? And so what we found, and Echo Green and Bridge Span just released a report last May, and they're like, you know, what's the problem with whether that's people of color or women being able to get large funding opportunities? And one of the reasons is not just because they don't know who the players are and how to get to the table, but they also don't know how to respond to grants and those opportunities the way funders want to receive information, right? And so we are essentially utilizing technology to say, we're going to take this information that you have, we're going to automate the processes, we're going to extract the data that's most important to funders, and we're going to alleviate you having to really do this type of reporting and extracting information because you're on the ground every day doing all of this work. And so a lot of what we're building is seeking to simplify that organizational, operational background work that nonprofits are, that they have to do to keep their organizations alive and sustainable.
I'll say hi to Paul, who just showed up. Savitri, you made a point in there that we've seen, Carrie and I talk a lot to various women of color business owners, tons of them, because of, for instance, American Express did a 100 for a 100 where they gave, I don't remember what it was, like 25,000 to 100 women business owners, all black. And 68% of women of color say that they're not, they don't have access to funds, like no matter what. They're just never getting their hand on the money. You're pointing to the nonprofit space where, again, there's this ridiculous gap between, there's a lot of people who want to do good things. There's a lot of people who at least want to like have the appearance of doing good, mm-hmm. but they haven't quite figured out where to put that money the way it's going to work. I asked you, what do you do to the nonprofits? How do you tell like Coke, this would be good Coke, you could really do this? Or is that your job? Is your job just to give them the mechanics to make sure their money gets spent in a better way? Like, what piece of the pie do you want to hold on to right there?
Yes. Yeah, so we are going directly into corporations. We're going directly into private foundations and other large philanthropic organizations and telling them, like, this is how you move the space forward. This is how you ensure that there's more equitable practices and who receives funding, and that 70% of it isn't going to people with Ivy League backgrounds because their connections work in the VP roles at the largest philanthropic organizations. And so, you know, they get to start a $10 million nonprofit overnight. And so bringing awareness to all of these things is important. I was having a conversation with Courtney Hodapp, who was the head of nonprofit engagement for JPMorgan Chase. And she frankly said, yes, you know, looking 2020 made me realize how my own implicit biases were actually directing where I was giving funds and how, you know, the people that I knew were getting, or people who knew people in my circle. And so how do we break up that dynamic and actually bring other organizations to the forefront? And by working across a double-sided market, we have access to nonprofits, and then we also have access to funders. And because funders sit on our platform, we know what they give to, we know what they like to give to, we know their history, we know what their problems are trying to solve, and we can actually introduce organizations that they would never see because they just wouldn't have access to these organizations to them. And so like in venture world, we would call this scouting, right? And so we can help scout for them and break down the barriers to entry that currently exist today.
Are you and the other recipients of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation scholarship like a network now? Do you support one another? How does that work?
You know, I feel like I was amongst the onset of Facebook. So the community is deeper now. And social media just connected people in a way that we just never connected. And I was on Facebook when LSU was like one of the first schools to get on Facebook. And most people didn't have a face on Facebook because they had these old dated cameras and maybe you got one photo. And now we're in a whole different world. And so we were literally just having a conversation about how do we reunite our class to see like where everyone is. But generally, I would say the Gates scholarship has connected alum in a way that has allowed people to collaborate.
Wouldn't that be awkward? You're like, you just ran off and you're like, I got mine. Starting living life. Yeah,
it was crazy. Like there was a group like, you know, called Mom and Dad, and it was talking about Gates because I don't think that anyone really, it was like transformative type of scholarship funding, right? And so I have seen philanthropy done right. And I feel like that scholarship was one of the ways that philanthropy was like done right. And Bill and Melinda said, like, they were criticized about that scholarship because, you know, they didn't give it to white kids, right? And so, and they, for 20 plus years, they're like, nope, we're not anyone else. You can be Indian, Native American, Black, Asian. And so they were criticized, but they were like, no, this is also a way to try to close the economic, socioeconomic gap, right? And so I appreciate them doing that and staying committed to doing that because it really did show like how you do philanthropy right.
Right, like on a systemic level, you already have such a huge head start versus these people who really, you know, have not had the advantages. So it made sense. Chloe's asking, do you find your work on the back end helps organizations with marketing on the front end?
Yeah, so we do streamline a lot of activities. For example, we help the organizations that we're working with tell their story better. And we do that via a number of ways. Like we automate key questions or, you know, what was your activities? And we try to essentially make it easier for organizations to recall like their narratives and also plug in quantitative and qualitative information in a way that is easily to digest. And then we essentially extract that into information that they can send out via their email list, they can send out via their social media. Those can be tailored around like fundraising. And so we try to do the heavy lifting. So it's like a plug and play type effort. And so that's one way that we're helping nonprofits with their marketing and making it easier, particularly in lieu of having a marketing office or a marketing director, right? Which most organizations would be considered like a luxury probably for small nonprofits.
I was thinking about something and it's probably a good time to bring Chad back in. Thank you, Jason. By the way, Jason, it's been a minute, hasn't it? Every time I see Jason, I just think of one time, one day, one event where I ran into him in person and I just hugged him, like had to. I was having like a horrible time. And
now he'd Jason be like, get away from me, plague carrier.
Don't touch me, COVID boy. Anyway, Savitri, let me grab in Chad because I'm going to ask you guys some similar questions. And I think there's probably some connection here. Hey, Chad. Hey. You both are people who, by the nature of the way society is, by the way the disparity in the world right now, have to be extra, have to do extra, have to do more, have to show up a little bit in a different way. And Chad, you just heard Savitri say that by comparison, there's always somebody's daughter or niece that gets $10 million and says, go make yourself a startup, you know, go have fun with that nonprofit, dearie. I hope you can help the giraffes or whatever.
She's like, another one? Oh my God, thanks.
Oh, another startup. Knowing that that's the stack against you, what do you do? What are your chips? What are your extra things you throw? Everyone says they have to be extra. So Savitri seems to be a master networker. She's doing a lot of that. What's a Chad Williams answer to that? What do you have to do to be extra?
Work harder. Just keep working, work harder than the person next to me. That's really it. I grew up playing like sports and I was always just like a hard worker. So just keep working hard. I feel like if you got like a great idea, then it will get the recognition that it needs.
Now, Chad's doing nonprofit at the very earliest stages of the Savitri. He's clearly not, you know, looking to ship, you know, 10 million water bottles to New Orleans. What's even the earliest bit of advice to help do process roll itself forward? Pretend, you know, he's paid you the $5,000 an hour to spend some time with you. What's a little bit of that? Like, let's listen in.
So the interesting thing is that's why we productized this, so people wouldn't have to pay me $5,000 to get the expertise so we could make it accessible. But when you're just starting off, like the key is to ensure that the foundation is solid and that your compliance is tight, because when it comes to funders wanting to give you money, these are the things that disqualify nonprofits from getting money. It's like, oh, is your Secretary of State stuff, basic stuff? You haven't updated your annual reports. You know, you need to ensure that you're filing your 990s on time. You need to ensure that they're filed correctly because some accountants don't file them correctly and they misappropriate funding in different places. And so really having your foundation solid is so important, because I feel like that is what truly keeps organizations in a position to compete.
The not sexy stuff.
The not sexy stuff, which is why resilient, you know, the compliance piece is so important to us as well.
All the paperwork, all the things that suck have to get done.
But it's funny when you just said that too. My LLC I did online with just, you know, ink file. Like I just throw down a credit card, boom, you're a corporation. Well, today they texted me earlier this morning before the show started saying, look, we've sent you a ton of emails to file your report. If you don't file this report, you're just a big stupid idiot. And I'm like, oh, so it's like, click here and we'll just do it right now. Now that was a $700 click, but that's all I had to do. And I didn't have to think about anything. I just clicked that button, and there's the file and it's done. I'm still a corporation.
So we do that for nonprofits too. So that's like, we literally have like that A through Z service, but you'd be surprised how many companies, LLCs, corporations just forget or don't have that click to have. And then they fall out of the standing.
Now you went and you raised. So Resilia is up $10 million or so dollars, which every single time you ask for a dollar, it's work. And also that means you get a brand new boss that you didn't want. Is Chad a guy who should raise to do a streetwear project, or should he crowdfund it? My belly says crowdfund, but you know more than me, Savitri. What do you say?
So I bootstrapped my first company and I actually bootstrapped Resilia early on. So I am a big believer of like bootstrap as far as you can get, and take your company as far as you can just with the capital that you have. I have a lot of friends who crowdfund, and we actually had a conversation on this with founders who've done both. And I actually think it's harder to crowdfund, personally. I think it's harder to deal with thousands of investors. And, you know, my friends said that sometimes they go into the grocery stores and their investors come up to them and say, oh, my God, I gave you $250, man. Like, what's going on? What's going on with the company, you know? Or they, you get emails and you have to respond. By SEC regulate, you have to respond to every single email. So I can, like, for me, it's like, oh, my gosh, having, like, hundreds or thousands of investors just gives me anxiety. However, raising capital, for me, it's like if you can get your story, your narrative, and all you need is, like, that one yes, like, really get the ball rolling. Is it easy? No. But I actually think you're better positioned today than you ever were before, because let me tell you, all these funds that have just been created to give to minority founders, to Black and Brown founders, did not exist when I was raising capital. So definitely take advantage of some of these new existing funds that are out now. But I do feel that, you know, if you can, we ran a process, very difficult raising capital, but if you can lock in your narrative, your story, get your key metrics, your KPIs down, it's not impossible. So, you know, crowdfunding, Chris is like pro crowdfund, which I can see you have this audience. And if you have, it's easier because I'm in SaaS, right? It's harder to also explain a SaaS company on a crowdfunding platform than it is a B2C company. If you're, you know, and then also crowdfunding, if you have people who are walking bodies with your merchandise on, if they're investing in your company, then they're going to really sing your praises unless you do something to piss them off. Then they're not going to sing your praises. But these are more ambassadors you have in the world who are basically selling your product, and they're going to even do it more if they feel like they're investing in your company.
I am 100%. Thank you for that advice. I think it's sometimes harder to like get in the when you're in fashion to get like investors to invest, but it's definitely doable.
Yeah,
100%.
Yeah,
and the behind it and whatnot. I feel like personally it would be the best option. I'm on Chris's team here because like the story and then whatnot. But then what you said with the 1,000 investors telling you what to do, it doesn't make sense. So it's like, you know.
Yeah, with streetwear, I think you're probably right.
It's hard though, because when Savitri said you're at the grocery store, that guy's like, "Where's that $250?
What about getting my money back?" You know,
I don't want that. You don't get that with a capital raise. All right, we got a couple more things to do. We got to get out of this show. This show's done. Hang on a minute.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
Here's what I want to do. I want to give it to Paul Bond over in Ireland because Paul bought a t-shirt and a hoodie off of Due Process. So
he's going to wear them in Ireland.
Yep. Yeah, that's amazing. I get that to you today too.
Paul's a runner. Paul's a runner. He does a lot of street races back when we still had those in the world. And he's committed to some really cool projects. Dave Davies says, this really is one of the best episodes I've seen in a good while. Looking forward to hearing the answers. I thought you were on vacation something.
Well, I'm going to write the people who were on yesterday with your regrets.
Dear Dave, dear Christopher B, Dave Davies does not like you. Here's his email. All right, we have one question we ask every single guest on here. You're answering a question that we've asked Mexican comedy horror actors, mashup artists, five-time world beatboxing champion Butterscotch, and now you. What goes in your backpack? These can be something physical, like an avocado, or it can be something metaphorical, like dreams. Carrie, what's a great physical something or other you could throw in the backpack?
Extra set of teeth. Or a book you hate, because eventually you'll read it if it's the only one you have, and you'll learn something from it.
And Carrie, what's a good metaphorical thing one could throw in a backpack?
Kindness.
At this point, I almost feel like we should warn every guest about this at the
We've had shenanigans happen at the backpack stage before, and one of them happened right before the second guest to answer said kindness, but we were all in such a state, we were just like, we basically laughed in her face for kindness, which is a really nice answer, and I feel bad about
it. What's a nice thing to add to the backpack? She says kindness, and my co-host and the other guest are laughing.
About the first thing, still.
Kindness.
It was, yeah. We didn't laugh at her. We were just still. Anyway, so I say it now as like, it's like atonement. Like I say it now as a good example because it was a very nice example.
You some time. All right, listen up. It's the fun loving criminals. Ladies first, Savitri Wilson, what are you going to throw in that backpack today?
So I would definitely have loose dollars. That's something that I always carry in with me, like just loose dollars to like give people or tip people.
I'm always thinking about those moments in life when someone says, yo, you got a couple dollars, and you reach in your pocket, there's the 20, and you're like, oh.
It's very important to carry loose dollars. I learned, my friends say that, man. I'm like a grandfather because of this, because no one carries dollars to them anymore. Everyone has credit cards. I'm like, well, how do you tip people? Like, how do you?
If I ever see Chris with a lot of $1 bills, I'm gonna be like, must be amateur night at the Squire. What you doing with all those ones?
All right, listen, this is when I worked in this wireless telecom company, one of my junior engineers, this amazingly hilarious guy we called Stamps. Stamps would come to work every day. We'd like have vending machines. I'd be like, Stamps, give me a dollar for the vending machine. We were like back and forth dollar friends. He gives me the dollar and it's got glitter on it. Like, no, thank you. Never borrowed a dollar off of Stamps again. No. So I like it. Loose dollars. Chad Williams, I bought you all the time I can, buddy. You better have a good one. What goes in that backpack?
So it's funny because Chris and Kerry, they told us about the question beforehand and I was trying to think of something the whole time, like the physical one. I also watched the show and like I seen the question. I couldn't think of the physical one, but the metaphorical one would be justice, just like justice for my people, justice for
big. Big.
Weathers candy, loose dollars and Weathers candy.
Like Weathers originals, is that what he's talking about? Like those beautiful
don't criticize. He likes what he likes. Okay.
I could put some Fuego hot sauce in it.
No, I think justice is fantastic and hard to come by in some situations. So
100%.
Yep.
Loose dollars. My grandmother had this great thing that would go on all the time where she, when anybody's birthday, she would buy them $10 in scratch tickets because you never know. It could be thousands of dollars. And she would take all 10 and she'd rip the last one off and she and I would scratch it at the table. And more often than not,